Welcome to this special edition of the Abstract Podcast on Equine Surgery. Today we are focusing on Equine Veterinary Education, July 2026.
That's right, Alex. We've had a number of requests from listeners to do these more focused deep dives into single issues of the major ECVS Tier 1 journals. So today, we're tackling Equine Veterinary Education Volume 38, Issue 7, July 2026.
It's a packed issue. We went through it and found 13 papers directly relevant to us equine surgeons, including a few case reports with their accompanying clinical commentaries, which should make for some interesting back and forth.
Indeed. Let's get started. First up, we have a pair of papers on an interesting application of modern technology.
This is a case report from DeBald and colleagues on using a 3D-printed, custom-designed tracheostomy tube in a 25-year-old Icelandic mare. The mare had a permanent tracheostomy, but the stoma was collapsing, causing respiratory distress, so they printed a custom stent.
It's a classic case report, an N of one. The innovation here is the material, a flexible but robust thermoplastic polyurethane, and the parametric design. They could digitally tweak the size, shape, and even stiffness of the tube as the wound healed and the stoma changed.
And that's the clinical magic right there. It's not a one-size-fits-all metal tube. They could make iterative adjustments on an ambulatory basis. The owner could even place it intermittently. It's an affordable, adaptable, and effective solution for a really frustrating complication. This is a great example of bringing new tech to the barn.
I agree. The value isn't in statistics, it's a proof of concept. It shows what's possible.
And speaking of what's possible, that case is immediately followed by a clinical commentary from Major titled, "Permanent Tracheostomy Meets 3D Printing, Surgical Technique and Innovation."
Yes, a well-placed commentary. It essentially discusses the DeBald case as a fantastic jumping-off point for a broader conversation. It highlights how this sort of creative problem-solving is becoming more accessible.
Exactly. Major's final point is the most salient. As the technology becomes cheaper and more available, the only real limit is our own imagination. We need to be thinking about how we can use these tools to solve other tricky surgical problems.
A good summary. Now, for another creative solution to a surgical complication.
This one is from San Clemente and colleagues. It's a case report on managing an uncommon complication after a prosthetic laryngoplasty, a tieback. The mare developed severe fluid accumulation at the surgical site that just wouldn't quit, even after a revision surgery.
The diagnosis was suspected iatrogenic trauma to the parotid salivary gland. The sheer volume of fluid was the giveaway. And their solution was novel.
It was genius. They injected botulinum toxin type A directly into the gland. 5 days later, the fluid production stopped completely. It essentially just turned off the tap. At the 7-month follow-up, the mare was back in work with no issues.
It's an elegant solution. But again, a single case report. We can't extrapolate a universal protocol from this. The dose, the injection technique, these things would need to be validated. I'm just glad they reported no signs of facial nerve paralysis.
I hear you on the stats, Sarah. But in the field, when you're faced with a complication like this, having an option like Botox in your back pocket is a massive step forward.
And following that case, there's a commentary from Hawkins titled simply, "Management of Parotid Gland Trauma in Horses."
There's no abstract for this one, but you can guess the content. It's almost certainly using the San Clemente case as a springboard to discuss the broader topic, how to recognize parotid trauma, what the conventional options are, and where this new botulinum toxin idea might fit in.
One would hope it also discusses prevention. It's a necessary piece to contextualize the case report, providing the background that a single case paper can't.
Okay, let's switch gears to colic. This paper by Watrobska and colleagues is a case series looking at peritoneal lactate concentration in Shetland ponies with non-strangulating intestinal lesions.
A retrospective look at 23 Shetland ponies. Their clinical impression was that Shetlands have higher belly tap lactates than you'd expect, even without a strangulating lesion. And the data supported that.
The median peritoneal lactate was 7.35 millimoles per liter. Sarah, in a 500 kilo warm blood, that number gets my immediate attention. It's well into the "we should probably be going to surgery" range. But in these Shetlands, it was associated with non-strangulating disease.
The authors are very upfront about the limitations. It's a small, retrospective sample, there's incomplete data, and no control group. The spin here could be quite heavy if you're not careful.
But the clinical takeaway is so important. It's a reminder that breed-specific variations exist. For a Shetland pony, a high lactate might not carry the same grave prognosis. It tells us to look at the whole horse, the pain level, the heart rate, the ultrasound findings, and not just react to a single number.
And that point is hammered home by the next piece, a commentary from the one and only Anthony Blixlager, titled Lactate and Colic Shetland Ponies as an Example of One Size Does Not Fit All.
He says it perfectly. The paper is a caution against what he calls biomarker tunnel vision. We can't let one value, no matter how compelling, dictate our entire clinical plan.
It's an excellent piece of editorializing. It underscores the importance of clinical judgment and experience over slavish adherence to reference ranges that may not even apply to the specific patient in front of you.
Now for a neonatal case. This is a case report from Desmarais and colleagues on congenital bilateral laryngeal paralysis in a newborn warm blood foal. The foal had inspiratory stridor right from birth.
My first thought is a structural, likely hereditary, abnormality with a poor prognosis. But that wasn't the case here at all. They suspected neonatal encephalopathy, or dummy foal syndrome.
Right. And they managed it medically. A nasotracheal tube for 24 hours to secure the airway, plus supportive care for the neonatal encephalopathy. And the foal's laryngeal function progressively recovered. A month later, it was totally normal at rest.
It's an N of one, but it's an important one. It demonstrates that bilateral laryngeal paralysis in a neonate can be a transient neurological dysfunction, not a permanent structural defect. A very different prognosis.
And hot on its heels is a commentary by Abraham that really helps frame this. The title is Congenital Bilateral Laryngeal Paralysis in a Neonatal Foal, Expanding Our Understanding of Neonatal Airway Dysfunction.
Abraham makes the excellent point that this is likely not a new disease, but rather a more dramatic presentation of the laryngeal and pharyngeal dysfunction we've long recognized in some foals with neonatal encephalopathy.
So it fits into an existing disease spectrum. That's a really helpful way to think about it. It means when you see a foal like this, you shouldn't jump straight to thinking about surgery. You should be thinking about treating the underlying systemic neonatal disease first.
Next, a tidy little case report from Blanc and colleagues about removing a metallic foreign body from a horse's nasopharynx.
This is a cool one. They used standing C-T to precisely locate the object, which was embedded in the nasopharyngeal wall. Then, they went in transnasally, with an endoscope, and used a diode laser to dissect it out. All on the standing, sedated horse.
The key here really is the preoperative imaging. The standing CT gave them the surgical roadmap. Without that level of detail, a transnasal approach would have been far more dangerous. It's a perfect illustration of how advanced imaging can facilitate minimally invasive surgery.
Absolutely. The pony was home in 24 hours and healed beautifully. That's a great outcome. And a testament to good planning and good tech.
All right, back to colic. A paper from Gandini and colleagues on volvulus nodosis of the small intestine.
Ah, yes, the knot in the intestine. I've always been taught this is a lesion of foals, but this clinical case series describes it in three adult horses, comparing them to two foals.
The anatomical descriptions are the most interesting part. They suggest in adults, the volvulus doesn't involve the mesentery forming a sac like it does in foals. Instead, one loop of jejunum acts like a post, and another wraps around it, creating a half hitch that strangulates two separate sections of bowel.
The scary part is, they say the clinical presentation in adults was milder, with less pain. That's a red flag for a strangulating lesion. You could easily underestimate the severity.
Well, let's be cautious. We're talking about three adults and two foals. This is hypothesis generating at best. The small number of cases is a major limitation, as they state. I'm not buying any firm conclusions just yet.
I hear you on the stats, Sarah. But in the field, this is still a step forward. Just knowing that this specific pathology, times can, times occur in adults, and that the signs might be subtle, is valuable information for any surgeon standing over a colic.
Okay, moving to a lameness-related paper. This one is from Knopp and colleagues. An analytical experimental study asking, does needle bevel orientation affect the diffusion of your nerve block?
A very practical question. They performed the lateral part of a low 4-point block on 12 horses using contrast media. On one side, the bevel faced proximally, and on the other, distally. They then took RADs over 30 minutes to see where the contrast went.
The result? It made no difference. Bevel up, bevel down. The proximal diffusion was the same. What did matter was time. The contrast media spread significantly more proximally between the injection time and the 30-minute mark, regardless of the bevel direction.
So the practical meaning is you can stop worrying about which way your bevel is pointing. The more important clinical pearl is to be aware of block creep. If you reevaluate a horse 30 minutes after your block, you might actually be interpreting the result of a block that's higher than what you intended to perform.
They do note their limitations. They use contrast, not local anesthetic, and radiographs are a 2D assessment. But for the question asked, it's a sound piece of work.
Next up is a case report by Hayden and colleagues on a 5-day-old Friesian colt with glandular hypospadias and congenital urethral atresia.
So a combination of urogenital birth defects. The colt presented with a uroperitoneum from a ruptured bladder because it had a membranous obstruction in its urethra and couldn't urinate properly.
A very sick foal. They took it to surgery, repaired the bladder, and created a functional urethral opening. The colt stabilized and reportedly did well after discharge.
It's a good, descriptive report of a successful outcome for a rare and complex set of congenital problems. It's a useful data point for anyone faced with a similar case.
And a good reminder for all of us to have a thorough look at the external plumbing of any male foal that isn't urinating, especially before they get sick enough to rupture their bladder.
Our final paper is a case series from Soham and colleagues on surgical excision of perianal melanomas.
And these aren't just little skin nodules. They describe excising massive melanomas in the anal region of 11 gray horses' tumors that were interfering with defecation and urination. This is aggressive surgery, including removal of the external anal sphincter and subsequent reconstruction of the anus.
It's a case series, so there's no control group. The procedure was performed standing in all horses, which is notable. They report a good outcome and high owner satisfaction.
And some might be skeptical about those subjective outcomes.
I am. High owner satisfaction is not a rigorous scientific metric.
But for these horses, the alternative is often euthanasia due to intractable pain or obstruction. This paper shows that even in what seems like a hopeless situation, aggressive debulking and reconstruction can provide a marked improvement in quality of life. It's a palliative procedure, certainly, but a valuable one. It offers a functional, comfortable life when other options are off the table.
A fair point. For end-stage cases, functional outcome is the primary goal. That wraps up this week's literature. Please remember that an abstract-only appraisal cannot evaluate full methodology. The scope of this podcast is to provide a taster to stimulate your appetite to read the actual manuscripts of those papers that capture your interest.
Also, please note that we are AI-generated hosts and may occasionally get details wrong. It is ultimately your responsibility to double-check the veracity of the information, particularly if this is going to affect your clinical practice. Thanks for listening.